cash, every movie costs $2,184.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Backtracks Theme Music. My name is Corey Morissette, joined, as always, by John Mariano. How you doing, Johnny?
I might run like Hayes, but I hit like shit.
That's right. I know on the last show, John said, there's two baseball movies I want to do. They're a couple of weeks apart. But immediately after taping the Moneyball episode, John's exact words, I believe, were, fuck it, we're doing Major League tonight.
How are you giving me credit for this? It's like you had such a rage boner to do this one too. Like, who are you kidding?
Oh, absolutely. This is, you called it a perfect movie before, and I agree 100%. This is one of my favorite movies of all time. Baseball, what, it doesn't matter. It's just a classic movie. We're talking 1989's Major League, starring Tom Berenger, Charlie Sheen, Corbin Burnson, Rene Russo, Bob Uecker, for fuck's sakes, Wesley Snipes, Dennis Haysbert, one of the all-time classics. I just finished reading, actually, The Making of Major League. It's a book. I got it for my Kindle. An absolutely amazing read on the production of this film, this low-budget little darling that has turned into, arguably, one of the greatest sports movies of all time.
So Corey, being that you just read The Making of It, why don't you do a little bit of the recap? I have some things to maybe pepper in and add after you're done. But why don't you give us the recap and let us know how this movie came to be, and kind of give us the plot of the movie.
All right. Well, the plot is kind of Ted Lasso-esque in that there's a Las Vegas showgirl who inherits the struggling Cleveland Indians baseball team from her deceased husband. She decides that she wants to move the team out of Cleveland to Miami. But in order to do that, they need to lose a certain percentage of games in order to break the lease with Cleveland. So she instructs her general manager to enact that escape clause, to put together just the worst possible team he can. So they get a sad sack manager who's working in a tire store. And when they ask him, hey, how would you like to manage the Cleveland Indians? He says, oh, let me get back to you. I got a guy on the other line about some white walls. So he's real dedicated to his baseball career at that point. You got Jake Taylor, an aging catcher with two bad knees, played by Tom Berenger. You got a prima donna third baseman in Roger Dorn, who cares more about endorsements than he does about baseball. You got a really old starting pitcher named Eddie Harris, who uses everything under the sun to doctor the baseball to get an extra couple of inches on his curveball. You got an outfielder in Pedro Serrano, who can't hit a curveball. And you bring in a guy by the name of Willie Mays Hayes, who, as John alluded to, runs like Hayes but hits like shit. And a rookie pitcher, Ricky Vaughn, who can throw 100-mile-an-hour fastball but has no control. So they nickname him Wild Thing. And this is the sad sack group of losers brought together to tank the season and get the team to Miami. And, of course, in true underdog baseball fashion, they become a team. And they find a common goal. And lo and behold, they start to play and they start to win. It's one of the most uplifting, fun movies you're ever going to see. Released in 1989. Wasn't a huge hit at the time. Grossed $75 million. Has now taken its place as one of the all-time sports classics.
So I have a couple of tidbits for you on this film, Corey.
Already?
So, Rachel Phelps, as you mentioned, inherits the team, and she's trying to get them to move out of Cleveland. She thinks Cleveland's a dump, right? So there was an alternate ending filmed of this movie. There was the original ending. Do you know what the original ending of this movie was?
I do, actually, because I read that book, and I believe it was she came out and told the manager that the whole ruse, it was a ruse to sabotage the team, that she actually wanted them to be motivated to become a winning team.
Yeah, so she was actually likable, and audiences hated it.
Yeah.
And they booed in the movie theater because they hated her so much they wanted to root against her. So the ending of the movie was changed.
And wisely so, because you need a villain. Without her, you don't have a villain in the movie.
Dennis Haysbert and Wesley Snipes both play two players, one known for hitting and one known for running. Dennis Haysbert was legitimately hitting home runs in batting practice. So some of these people, including Charlie Sheen. Charlie Sheen has, in interviews, like, we know he's abused substances. He's been open and talked about it. But on the set of this movie, he was taking very different substances. Do you know what they were?
Not offhand. No, I don't.
He was taking some steroids on this film.
Oh?
And he was able to get his fastball up to 85 miles an hour. Not quite the 99, but for an actor pitching who had... it's pretty good. Charlie Sheen, before he was an actor, was on track to possibly be a professional baseball player. And things happened and he became an actor instead. But he has said, you know, he got up. So some people really have that athletic ability. One actor in particular didn't. And that would be Willie Mays Hayes, played by Wesley Snipes.
Yes.
Wesley Snipes was not a good hitter. And apparently didn't run that fast either. That's all movie magic, making all of that happen. But he brings such a swag and charisma to the character that all the music, movie magic be damned, he becomes a real player. And now I have two other facts that you can't look up.
Okay.
I had mentioned when we talked about Moneyball that I play a lot of fantasy baseball.
Mm-hmm.
And I have four fantasy baseball teams. Two out of those four teams have names derived from this movie. So one of them is Lou Brown's Bums, who's very famously named after the manager of the Cleveland Indians from this movie.
Right.
And the other one, I play in a league with our friend Ken Knapsack, and the name of that team is Dorn E5. And the Dorn E5, people say it all together and they think that's one thing. But Dorn E5 means that Roger Dorn makes errors on third base, because E5 is how you score it in baseball when you make an error on third base. So it's the Dorn E5, which is a statement of where Roger Dorn is in his career, because there's an entire montage of Dorn making errors and messing up on third base.
Great part of the montage, though, when he's just sitting there just shagging balls and they're just bouncing all off him and his biceps are all bruised up, and he does work on it. Everybody kind of gets their moment to shine in this one, even after, Charlie Sheen sleeps with his wife. But we'll get into that. We can get into the movie a little bit. The movie, or the song you picked, is from a band I don't know anything about, but it's a song everybody knows. The song is Wild Thing. Of course, Ricky Vaughn, Charlie Sheen's character, is nicknamed Wild Thing in the movie. This is his walkout song in the season finale against the Yankees. And I was telling John, it's one of my all-time favorite scenes in cinema, because you see Lou Brown kind of look at the fence and yell, "Give me Vaughn," and you hear the feedback from the guitar kind of kicking in. And then once when the guitar kicks in, the door opens and Ricky Vaughn struts out with the horn-rimmed glasses, looking cool as fuck, confident as hell. And it's one of those jump-to-your-feet moments in film that just it can't help but get you pumped up.
No, it's one of these anthems that when you hear it, and all due respect to the Trogs, and all due respect to Tone Loc, who does his own variation on Wild Thing, this to me is the definitive version of this song. And it might be because when I saw this movie in 1989, but it's also the punk riff to this really just kicks it off and gets you going, and it's such a sing-along version of the song.
And it is actually listed, I'm looking it up here, by the Houston Press, includes this version as one of their 10 greatest versions of the song Wild Thing. Considering you have the Trogs, you have Susie Sue from Susie and the Banshees doing a version. Jimi Hendrix did a version. Like, there's a lot of versions out there. So to make the top 10, I think, is pretty impressive. The band X, apparently they're still around, kind of by looks of things. I don't think it's this lineup that we're about to hear here. This was a non-album single for them in 1989. It's become a staple at sporting events, particularly baseball games, of course. And actually, John Moxley is using this as his entrance music in All Elite Wrestling. I don't watch a lot of All Elite Wrestling, but I thought it's the perfect walkout song.
And John Moxley, formerly of Dean Ambrose fame from WWE, is kind of a modern era anti-hero wrestler, and this really fits him. He has a similar attitude, I would say, to Ricky Vaughn in a lot of ways, his wrestling persona at least. And he's very, very much that anti-hero who goes against the grain and goes against the rules. So it makes a lot of sense that he'd use this as his entrance song.
All right, what do you say? I'm chomping at the bit, John. Can we play this thing now?
Please.
All right, this is X and Wild Thing from 1989's Major League.
I wanted to stop it before it really hit. That's the moment in the movie where you're just waiting for those doors to open and Ricky Vaughn to come out, right? And if that feedback doesn't get you pumped watching a ball game or watching this movie, I don't know what will, because there's such an anticipation that builds in the movie.
Oh, it's amazing. And if you're listening, crank up your podcast player, your headphones, whatever you're listening to us on right now, crank it up, because shit's about to get fun.
This song was 1983. It comes out in 89, but gives the movie a real like borderline 90s edge, right?
Mm-hmm.
The movie needed this edge because let's talk about the team for a minute. The team are a bunch of castoffs, right? They were given kind of like Moneyball. They were given no budget, but to such a degree that they're pulling players out of the penitentiary and people off the street, and Cuban players, back when Cuban players weren't being brought into Major League Baseball. Like Pedro Serrano's character, it's amazing because you look at it now and you look at all the great Cuban players that we got in the 90s and the 2000s injected into the major leagues. And those international players weren't really a thing when this movie came out. So it was being mocked as like, well, that's the lesser league. And then this movie was there to show you a guy like Serrano exists in those leagues. And we got to see those kind of players for years to come.
That's right. And Pedro Serrano defected from Cuba because he wanted to seek the freedom to practice his religion. And that religion, of course, is voodoo.
Yeah. And he prays to
Jobu.
and as great as Jobu is, Jobu can't hit the curve.
My favorite part is when Steve Harris is like, are you telling me Jesus Christ can't hit a curveball?
Yeah. It's so many great exchanges in this movie. And Dennis Haysbert does such a great job with his character. He would go on to later play President Palmer on 24 and have many other great roles. He does the Allstate commercials now. Yeah, you know, he's such a not just well-spoken, but he has such a great presence on the screen. It's amazing that his presence as Serrano is kind of the same, but kind of different, because I was convinced he didn't speak a lick of English watching this movie.
Voodoo was really quite the thing for late 80s baseball. I remember, didn't one of the players in Bull Durham have to sacrifice a live chicken to take the curse off his bat?
Well, a lot of that comes from Wade Boggs, is a funny thing. Wade Boggs, and at some point we will talk about It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia on this show and probably that specifically that Boggs episode, but Wade Boggs would eat chicken before the game. You know, he'd eat fried chicken, like a bucket of fried chicken or whatever the legend was, but he would eat several pieces of chicken before each game. It was like part of his routine. So that starts tying into a lot of these legends of sacrificing live chickens and things like that, is that all of these baseball players had these different routines with different things that they would do before the game. And they wanted to incorporate that and show you how ludicrous they could get. And it wasn't like the movie wasn't as ludicrous as what some of the other players would do in the game.
Yeah. In hindsight, Pedro Serrano wasn't, he just, you know, had a little bit of rum. with Jobu, and it's very bad to touch Jobu's rum. He's very bad.
Oh, he's very bad. Right, and we learn that in the movie the hard way.
Yeah, and Eddie Harris particularly finds out the hard way. A quick shout out to the lead singer of X, Xene Cervinka, Cervinka, I think. I'm probably butchering her name, and I apologize for that. Apparently, she's still with X, and out there performing at the ripe old age of 67. She sounds amazing on this track, though.
Oh, she absolutely slays on it, and you know, they say it's like a top 10 version of the song. I find it hard to believe this isn't a top five version of the song. Like, I know where they're giving credit, where credit's due and whatnot, musically or whatever, but this is a great version of the song. It's perfect for the purpose it's used, and I can't see myself listening to the Wild Thing songs out of a sporting venue because of the song and the use of it.
Here's a little bit of baseball trivia for you, John. Have you ever heard of a relief pitcher by the name of Mitch Williams?
I actually have. He was a San Francisco Giant, right?
Yes, he was a Cub as well. But he used to come out to Wild Thing. He actually modeled, kind of his playing style to Ricky Vaughn a little bit. And us baseball fans in Canada know Mitch Williams because that's who Joe Carter hit the series-clinching home run off of in the Toronto Blue Jays' second World Series in 93.
Yeah. Yeah, that's one of those legendary home runs. I was talking earlier about the Jake Taylors of the world. Jake Taylor reminds me a lot. I think it was the 88 World Series, Dodgers, Oakland A's. And Kirk Gibson, very famously with no knees, hits a home run in that World Series. And it's very reminiscent of Jake Taylor's character. Played different positions and everything else, but from you know, his outward look and the way he played the game at that point, very Jake Taylor-esque.
Yeah, very much so. Can we talk a little bit? We only got a minute 34 left in the song, and there's so much about this movie to talk about. Can we talk about the brilliance of Bob Uecker? My God, you talk about somebody who deserved a Best Supporting Actor, not nomination, but win for his performance in Major League. Bob Uecker is a treasure. And a little piece of trivia, David S. Ward, who wrote the film and directed the film, chose Bob Uecker because of his work in Miller Lite beer ads, not knowing that he was the radio broadcaster for the Milwaukee Brewers for 20 years.
It's so great. And what's funny is this movie is largely filmed in Milwaukee.
Yeah.
So, you know, having Uecker there feels right and also makes it more of a baseball movie, right? Like, he's Mr. Baseball.
Yes.
You know, I had only known him as the dad on Mr. Belvedere at the time. I don't know about you, but like, not that I wasn't watching much baseball, but I wasn't watching a lot of out-of-market baseball. So I wasn't aware. It's not like today where like you pop on SportsCenter and you hear home run calls all around the country or whatever. Right. It's like I knew my Yankee announcers and that was about it. And my father, like when I saw this movie with him, told me a lot about the great Bob Uecker and his contributions to baseball and being the voice of the Brewers and all of that. And you know, you talk about like your Harry Carries of the world. you know, there are certain announcers, John Sterling with the Yankees at this point, there are certain announcers that have become legends of the game. And Uecker might not have been the first, but in the 80s, he was one of the most prominent.
And up in Canada, we didn't get Milwaukee Brewers baseball. We got Blue Jays and Expos, of course. But from our American satellite dishes, all we got was Chicago Cubs and Harry Carey and Atlanta Braves, thanks to the TBS Superstation. So I didn't know a lot of, and I didn't watch a lot of Mr. Belvedere. I knew Bob Uecker from the Millerite ads, but man, is he excellent in this film. And he ad-libbed the majority of his lines, including the classic "just a bit outside," which is the name of the Making of Major League book that you can find on Amazon right now.
It's, you know, and his descent into hell of drinking as the team goes on its losing streak is one of the most legendary sequences in sports history. And who's his color guy who drops those lines in? But they're not really lines as much as, you know, Uecker's really filling the room. And then he's got like a line or two in there as the color guys.
He barely says anything.
Yeah.
I can't remember his character's name offhand, but I just remember Uecker going, "That's why you're the best color man in the business."
Yeah. Yeah. And that's why I know he's the color guy, right? One other piece of trivia. So, you know, in the sequel, and the sequel is not nearly as beloved as this one, but Randy Quaid has that character, which was probably the breakout character, one of the major breakout characters of the sequel, who just shits on the team the whole time. There was a character like that that they filmed for the original. That sounds like, you know, for the sequel, they just took that concept and then recast it as Randy Quaid. It all hit the cutting room floor, not because it was bad or anything, just because they ran out of space for it in the movie. It like hurt the pacing. Do you know who played the character?
No, I don't.
He would go on to play a famous agent on TV, but not a sports agent, a movie agent, a talent agent.
Jeremy Piven.
A young Jeremy Piven would have appeared in this movie as a young Cleveland Indians fan. I can only imagine how much comedy gold ended up on that cutting room floor with him him having a role like that.
That would have been pretty cool. David S. Ward, I want to shout him out quick, the writer-director. Just an amazing job on this film. He was inspired to write and direct Major League because he figured that was the only time he'd ever get to see his beloved Cleveland Indians win anything, was to put it in a movie. And, of course, since then, they would go on to win the World Series.
Yeah. But many years later. And what's funny is they after this movie, they start winning. Like in 97, they knocked the Yankees out of the playoffs. Right? They got some great bats. They got like Manny Ramirez. So they become a really great team in the late 90s and make a run. Before we get back into the movie, though, we're listening to a theme song of a closer. Sparky Lyle, I was just reading, in the late 60s, early 70s, was the first major league closer to popularize walkout music. I don't know, even know what the song was, but that's where it started. It was like 1967-ish.
Oh, really?
So about 20 years before this movie comes out, it wasn't, because I almost felt like, did this movie inspire people like Mariano Rivera and Trevor Hoffman? Trevor Hoffman came out to Hell's Bells. Mariano Rivera very famously came out to Enter Sandman. Edwin Diaz on the Mets is now coming out to Narcos. So they all have this walkout music. And I thought it stemmed from this idea of, or this concept of Charlie Sheen. But this script was so thorough. It was pulling everything that was going on in the major leagues, right? Including the walkout music, right? Which I think is pretty great, because now when you think about closers in baseball, you completely associate them with what they walk out to.
Well, and to go back to talking about superstitions, John, I was just reading a little bit of trivia here. During the 2016 baseball season, real-life Cleveland Indians players Jason Kipnis and Mike Napoli acquired two Jobu statues and set them up at a shrine in the team's locker room?
Yes. Yes. Kipnis and Napoli. Kipnis was a second baseman slash utility guy, and Napoli was a DH slash catcher. And to try and get some good vibes, Everyone embraced this movie, right? So it's a very beloved movie in the baseball community because it really shows a genuine love of the game and a love for the game. It shows what players go through. They actually made most of the players go through their own spring training, to make the game more realistic and the plays more realistic. You know, and they also tried to get actors who had experience playing, like Charlie Sheen and Dennis Haysbert. They wanted people who look like they can throw a fastball, who could hit a ball over the fence. And then, you know, you get somebody charismatic like Wesley Snipes, and then you throw the gag in there that his character can't hit, but he can run, and you can fake running, so he doesn't have to fake hitting at all.
All those pop-ups are real that he kept popping up there. Just to finish off the Kipnis Napoli tidbit, they initially placed vodka in the shrine and then switched it to rum. And when they did that, that resulted in a 6-0 victory over the Tampa Bay Rays. And then in July of that year, they even sacrificed a supermarket chicken to help end teammate Yan Gnome's slump. So
go ahead and tell me about your money ball and your statistics. Right, players are still trying to sacrifice chickens and give false idols rum. So take that, Moneyball.
All right, let's keep going here.
I know we're getting into the rundown of the song, but the song is really short, and there's still so much to cover, you know. And we haven't even mentioned Rene Russo yet. And while she has a small part, it's a critical part because she plays the love interest to Jake Taylor, and she's a former athlete. Do you remember what sport she played?
It wasn't like tennis or something, was it?
I thought it was like track or something.
Oh, in the movie?
Yeah, in the movie.
Yeah, I always thought you meant.
Or was she a swimmer?
She was a swimmer. Yeah,
she's a swimmer, right? Because she has a very posh party that Jake Taylor accidentally shows up at because he's sort of stalking her, but he's trying to reconnect with her in the worst way possible, and ends up trying to fumbling his way through a party as her boyfriend belittles him for not being very well read. So Jake Taylor is, then we see him with character development, starting to read and better himself and turn himself into the man that Rene Russo would be attracted to.
Now at that party you mentioned, John, they asked Jake Taylor how much he makes in the major leagues. And he says he's making the league minimum. In 1989, what was the league minimum?
Oh, what was it? Probably $250,000,
$68,000. Which is still
off.
About, according to IMDb, which was roughly double the average household income in 1990. So still a pretty good salary.
No, it's still a pretty good salary. It's way up now.
Yeah.
It's way up now. I thought it was even higher by then, but I think it gets bumped up to that probably around the turn of the century or a little bit after. It's like after one of the strikes, I think it gets bumped up to that.
Is it still in the six figures, or have we hit seven figures yet for league minimum?
No, I think it's still six figures, but I think it's like mid six figures now. I think it's closer to like 500 grand or 600 grand now.
Gotcha. It's the fade out, John.
I know, but you owe us a story, Corey.
I do?
Yeah, you do. I can't let the song end until you give us the story. You're supposed to tell us about Ricky Vaughn's affair with Roger Dorn's wife.
Oh, that's right. A young Ricky Vaughn is seduced by an older lady, not knowing that it's the wife of his teammate, Roger Dorn. He's kind of a dipshit through most of the movie. And you wonder how this is going to play out in the final. What is it? It's kind of the tiebreaker game to decide who goes on at the playoffs, right, between the Yankees and the Indians.
Yeah, it's the tiebreaker game. Isn't Parkman the villain in this one? That's this one, right?
So this is a Clue Blakeman, I want to say.
Parkman's a sequel, right? Clue Haywood is like in Ricky Vaughn's head, and Dorn plays it. You don't know how it's going to play out, like you said, and. In the climax of the movie, you can see Ricky's a little bit in his own head, and Dorn calls a mound visit, and Taylor, at the catcher, is like, shit. And you know, very famously, Roger Dorn turns to Ricky, and you think Ricky thinks he's gonna give him shit for like sleeping with his wife or something. He's like, strike this motherfucker out. And he delivers it. It's Corbin Burnson's delivery on the line that sells it so well.
Yeah, maybe his best line read of his entire career.
And then after the game, he punches him out after the game, and then they hug. Right.
Yeah.
you know, and it's like a great moment, and they like laugh it off. He's like, you know, kind of like I had to hit you because you slept with my wife, and now we're good. And it's very very much a baseball macho man kind of way to handle things. Is here you get your licks in because you slept with my wife, but we're good.
Yeah.
And it was a very cool way to handle it. But I love that mound visit, you know. And we're not going to stop this again. So the other thing I'm going to talk about is, you know, they bring in Willie Mays Hayes as a pinch runner.
Well, I was going to ask you, I'm going to set the table for you. It's bottom of the ninth. Yeah. Okay. Hayes hits a two-out single, right? And then he steals second. And then Jake Taylor comes up to bat. John, take it away.
So Jake Taylor comes up to bat, and Jake Taylor calls his shot, like Babe Ruth. He points to left center field, and I am going to hit it straight out. And the pitcher laughs at him, and the pitcher dusts him back. And the dust back is when you throw it like high and inside and knock the player down. And Jake Taylor dusts himself off and in slow motion calls his shot again. And the pitcher's like, the nerve of this guy. So everyone's like backing up. They're getting ready for Jake to just rock it because they know it's like the last that bad of his career. And he's trying to make a name for himself. And he just grooves one in there. And Jake, rather than swing away, drops a bunt down the third base line, and the third baseman is like, oh shit. And he goes running, and everything's happening in slow motion. Snipes is off to the races on contact. And Willie Mays Hayes is flying around the bases because he's the fastest guy in the major leagues. And it is just a slow motion run of Tom Berenger. Why am I tripping over Jake's name now? Jake Taylor's name.
Jake Taylor.
Right. So Jake Taylor is running in slow motion with two busted knees down the line and barely beats out the throw. And then they see Willie Mays Hayes had turned third and is running home, and they throw it home, and we get the safe call at home for them to win the game. And it's just this perfect baseball moment. And then we cue the music, and everyone's celebrating, everyone except for the owner, who is upset because they have the new ending in there, and she has been foiled by this team who had a stand-up, which we didn't bring up. Lou Brown brings up a stand-up of her fully clothed, and they have to win so many games, however many games they need to win for the rest of the season. And, Corey, what happens every time that they win a game?
They peel a section of clothing off. She was a burlesque dancer. In the film. So yeah, it's a fully clothed shot of her, but for every game they win, I can't remember how many games they needed to win to clinch the pennant. But for every game they won, Lou Brown would remove a section of clothing. He started with like the shoulders. And as they won, he kept peeling things off. And at the very end, the last piece was right across the old jumblies.
Yeah, the owner who had passed had married like a former Vegas burlesque dancer. And they took advantage of one of her glamour pictures and turned it into a standee in the locker room. So it was like their great motivation for this run. There's a lot of fun parts of this movie. I think we've covered most of them, Corey.
Yes. I just wanted to point out that that's really kind of the beauty of baseball, is you get those dramatic moments. And it was engineered perfectly by David S. Ward, but that doesn't happen in a lot of sports where you get that kind of intrigue, where you got a player calling a shot. First, you need that two-out single. Then you need the stolen base. Then you need, you know, calling your shot twice, getting the dust off, and then laying down the bunt and executing all that perfect. That, to me, is really kind of the beauty of baseball. Let's finish off the last 22 seconds of the song, and let's talk about the future of Major League. Yeah, wasn't a lot left, but that's Wild Thing by X from the film Major League. Now, as John mentioned, there are sequels. Major League 2 came out, which featured most of the original cast. Wesley Snipes did not come back. And then there was a Major League Back to the Minors, which acts as the third film. But way back in 2010, they were developing a real, like a proper sequel, third sequel to Major League, to be called Major League 3, that was going to bring back original writer and producer David S. Ward, Charlie Sheen, Tom Berenger, and even Wesley Snipes. And the plot was going to be Ricky Vaughn coming out of retirement to work with a young player.
And the young player was going to be Ricky Vaughn's estranged son.
Oh.
Yeah, I had seen an interview on that earlier tonight, and that never came to be. But Ward and Sheen don't acknowledge, because neither one of them were involved with the third movie, they don't acknowledge that as a true sequel. Just acknowledge that as a completely different franchise, different movie.
Right.
And mostly because it's not a very good movie, which is a shame. Because actually, it does have a pretty good cast. But it doesn't have a lot of common ground. The sequel tried to capture some of the magic, repeats some of the same jokes, some of the choices that were made, especially, you know, making Vaughn into a sellout weren't very well received. You know, people were going for more of the coolness of Ricky Vaughn. And when he turns out to be the sellout, it's like, that wasn't the character I was looking to see. It made sense. Like, from a writing standpoint, it made sense. But it didn't play on the audience's expectations and fell a little flat. But there are some great moments in it. Like the Pedro Serrano losing his mojo and being taunted by the new Japanese player who's telling him he's lost his marbles. You know, and he's trying to say huevos, I think, but he calls them marbles. And he starts holding his hands out as if they were big brass balls and mocking him. Like, you have no balls. And once Pedro figures that out, he finds his mojo again and starts swinging away. So there are some good moments in it. But it's not the same. It doesn't have the same magic as the first one.
Now, the latest piece of Major League news, way back in 2017, Morgan Creek, which is the studio that produced Major League, as well as a lot of other classics from the late 80s, early 90s, they announced that they were going to reboot all their classic films from the 80s and 90s, including Major League, Young Guns, and Ace Ventura. My question is, do we need those? Because we've already got one really great Ace Ventura movie, one really great Major League movie, and a couple of pretty damn good Young Guns movies.
And I would say a pretty good Ace Ventura movie in there too. And a not terrible Major League movie, right? Like, you know, and that's probably how I would describe all of those movies. Like, Ace Ventura When Nature Calls is not nearly as good as the first one, but some of the gags in it, including, you know, a rhino giving birth to Ace Ventura, there's some classic stuff in that movie. You know, the Monopoly Man bit. So there's a couple of things in that movie. Major League 2, kind of the same thing. It's uneven and maybe not perfect, But the Young Guns 1 and Young Guns 2, perfect movies. I think that touching any of these would be crazy. I would re-release them. I might restore them. And that's about it.
Let's do all new 4K transfers of these films and let's re-release them. I love that idea.
Yeah, I wouldn't touch a one of these. I'm all for taking movies like Howard the Duck, for instance. It's kind of a cult favorite. People kind of like, I don't even want to call it a cult classic. It's a very flawed movie. If you want to go ahead and remake Howard the Duck, by all means, go remake Howard the Duck. Mm-hmm. But there were certain movies of that time. Like, I don't think you remake Ferris Bueller's Day Off.
Right?
I think if you want to see Ferris Bueller's Day Off, go watch Ferris Bueller's Day Off. They did it right the first time. And I feel like that about a lot of movies, you know, and how they're remade. When John Carpenter remade The Thing, the original Thing, while it's enjoyable, is by no stretch of the imagination the classic John Carpenter turned The Thing into. When Cronenberg made The Fly, the same thing. The original Fly, people kind of laughed at the gag of the help me. It was almost like a Twilight Zone episode. Mm-hmm. But to see what happens with Jeff Goldblum's transformation, that's a movie that should never be remade, right? And there are movies that warrant remakes. Sometimes it's done well. I'm going to bring up one, maybe a less popular one here, but they remade Dracula several times, and everyone has their favorites, right? It's not always just the original. My personal favorite is Oldman, right? So some people love Christopher Lee. Yeah, you know, some people love the classics. There's enough to cherry pick there. Sometimes it works. Material like that that's in the public domain or in the public domain adjacent, that works. Some of this other material, though, too soon.
Yeah, you need a reason. I think back to one of my favorite remakes is actually the Coen Brothers' True Grit. And there's a perfect reason for that remake. Obviously, the John Wayne one is really great, but it told the story through Rooster Cogburn's eyes, whereas the Coen Brothers tells the story through the girl's eyes, kind of like the book did. You're taking a different approach to it. You can't do that with Major League or Young Guns or Ace Ventura. They're untouchable. All you're going to do is make inferior versions. And what's the point? For people who kind of know me outside of podcasting, I'm actually on a board that's opening a movie theater in my hometown here. And my God, if they gave us like a 4K transfer of Major League, Ace Ventura, and Young Guns, I could fill the auditorium every night showing those. If the pandemic showed us anything, when no new movies were coming out, theaters were getting pretty good draws on classics like Jurassic Park, Jaws, E.T. All these great movies were coming back into theaters and people were coming out for them because they missed that. You tell me Major League wouldn't fill a theater on a Friday night or Young Guns? Come on. That's money in the bank.
The only reason why you could remake Major League is because baseball itself has changed so much. But it's honestly not a movie I'd want to see. Like, as we covered in the Moneyball episode, I don't think that baseball as a game has gotten better since the late 80s. And I think it's not just my opinion. Attendance is down. Revenue is down. Things are down in baseball. Popularity is down. I don't know that that's the thing you need to revisit. If you want to repopularize the game, make changes within the game first and then make movies about it.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's put a bow on this one, John. That's Wild Thing from 1989's Major League. Join us next week when we cover 60 Minute Man from the movie Bull Durham. I'm sure that's going to be next. But until then, John, where can the folks find you and what do you got coming up?
Oh, you can find me on Twitter at John Mariano NY. You can tweet all your baseball stuff, all your movie stuff, and all your music stuff at me. Or just tweet at me in general. Like, I sometimes get lonely and I like the company. You can also find me on Backtracks, Aerosmith Revisited with Scott Haskin and Corey Morissette. We like to talk about Aerosmith on that show because that's the name of the show. But it's a very fun band to cover, and we're about a fifth of the way through the catalog now, Corey.
I wish. No, probably a fifth, it would be fair, yeah. And you can catch John and I in our new show, Backtracks Major League, which is going to be coming out soon, because I could talk about this movie just ad nauseum, and we already have, unfortunately, for all you poor folks. But thank you very much for giving us a listen here tonight. We're a proud member of the Deep Dive Podcast Network. Go to deepdivepodcastnetwork.com, find Deep Dive Podcast Network on Twitter, get a hold of all the shows. We got some absolute classics on there you're going to want to check out. If you want to tweet at me, again, about movies, about music, or I get lonely too, at CD Morset is the handle. And yeah, let us know what you think of Major League, because this is an all-time favorite of ours. Hopefully it is of yours as well. And hopefully you like the show. I want to thank you very much for giving us a listen here tonight. And on behalf of my buddy John, my name is Corey, and we'll see you next time on Backtracks Theme Music.
Top of the sixth, and rookie sensation Ricky Vaughn on the pitch now. You can close the book on Kelner.
Oh, thank God.
Relax, Ricky. We're only four runs down. We're still in this game.
You take it to him?
Oh, all right.
Look, man, guy gets a second, first sign indicator.
Vaughn, a juvenile delinquent in the offseason in his Major League debut.
I'm gonna light your ass up, meat.
Vaughn into the windup in his first offering. Just a bit outside. He tried the corner and missed. Ball four. Ball eight. Low, and Vaughn has walked the bases loaded on 12 straight pitches. Boy, how can these guys lay off pitches that close?
Wild thing! You make my heart sing. You walk everything.
Taylor, what are you doing back up here?
Couldn't cut it, the Mexican League.
That's your wife and my kids.
Vaughn in deep trouble here with Clue Haywood, last year's American League home run champ, at the plate. Vaughn kicks, fires. Here is a swing and a drive toward left field and deep. Oh, boy.
No way. Too high.
It is gone off the reservation. A grand slam home run for Haywood.
Looked like a strike anyway.
Where you go? Too high? What does that mean, too high?
Too high.
So Vaughn is off to a rocky start as Haywood clears the bases with one swing.
Not too high, too hard, right?
First it was really high.
Who gives a shit? It's gone.